"Miss Billy," said Dr. Ted Nashford, "what a lame performance." Similar protests from all around the table, with Letty Withers repeating her line over and over again like a refrain. "Boys can't be coy, Billy." A bemused smile formed on one side of Billy's lips, and his eyes looked upward into an unfathomable distance. Obviously, the compunction to keep a secret on the one hand, and natural-born loquaciousness and the desire to star at dinner-table conversation on the other, were locked in mortal combat inside his big head. To everyone's surprise, compunction triumphed. "I just can't," he said, with his eyes cast down and his head oscillating. "I should have kept my mouth shut, and it ain't nothing more'n a rumor in the first place." Letty, Opie, and Ted Nashford continued to rag him, while Doris fixed him with a reproving stare. Dessert consisted of three kinds of pies, pecan, lemon meringue, and apple, and three kinds of ice cream, vanilla, peach, and peppermint. All of it was homemade. The ice cream had been hand-churned right out there on the screen porch beyond the kitchen by Auntie Bella and her helpers, as Charlie heartily informed everybody. Afterward, a great chorus of praise of what a great dinner it had been. Even Herb and Marcia Richmond joined in. So Charlie said, "Mason, ask Auntie Bella come on out here a second." Auntie Bella was a fleshy woman with dark skin and gray hair, which she had pulled straight back into a tight little bun. The light from the hearth shimmered on her face and her bare arms, which were already glistening from the heat of the kitchen. She was wiping her hands on a big, workmanlike apron. Obviously accustomed to these curtain calls of approbation, she beamed at Charlie and his guests.
"Your ears probably been buzzing in there, Auntie Bella," said Charlie. "You've been getting an awful lot of compliments."
In truth, the compliments now poured forth, not only from the regulars, such as Billy and Doris Bass and the judge, but also from Francine Hendricks, Lenore Knox, Livin Lydia, and, Charlie was pleased to see, Herb Richmond, although his soft voice was lost in the general happy clamor. Then Marcia Richmond, turning in her seat so that she could smile directly at Auntie Bella, spoke up in a very ladylike southern voice.
"I don't know how you do it. To tell you the truth, I'm usually not crazy about okra, collard greens, and snaps, but yours just melted in my mouth. You've got to tell me your secret."
Auntie Bella pulled her head back and smiled broadly at Marcia Richmond, and shook with a couple of silent chuckles, and then let loose a laugh from deep in her throat, and said,
"Welcome to Greece."
Tremendous laughter from all around the table.
"Welcome to Greece!"
Oh, it was priceless. Auntie Bella was a card, all right. Not even Charlie himself had ever heard that line before. Everyone was in convulsions. Well, not everyone. Charlie noticed that Marcia Richmond was still smiling, but her face had fallen. She looked as if she had just been shot through the heart. After dinner, Charlie led the party out to the stone terrace at the rear of the gunhouse. He had instructed Mason to make sure the terrace lights were kept off. He didn't want anything to dilute the effect of the nocturnal landscape he had prepared for his guests. He stuck close to the Richmonds, hoping for maximum astonishment. They didn't disappoint him. It was Marcia Richmond, a sharp intake of breath. Flames! In the middle distance, a stupendous arc of fire cut through the blackness of the plantation at night. The silhouettes of the pine trees in the foreground rose like enormous bars. The pungent odor of burning sedge and scrub pine was thick in the air. Charlie made a point of inhaling and then letting his breath out with a satisfied, "Ah! Nothing else on earth like it." In truth, the aroma made his heart thump with an emotion he couldn't have begun to describe.
"Wow, what's going on, Charlie?"
It was Herb Richman. Charlie felt he was getting somewhere at last. For the first time, the man had broken out of his lethargic mode.
"We're burning over the fields, Herb."
"What for?"
"If you don't burn 'em over in the spring, they'll be so overgrown with saplings, vines, thorns. It'd be like Brer Rabbit's briar patch. You remember Brer Rabbit's briar patch?"
"Not really," said Herb Richman.
"Well, they'd get so overgrown you'd have to forget about hunting. Not even a dog'd be able to get through."
He was pleased to observe that Herb Richman was staring slack-jawed at the sight.
"But how do you keep it
"From getting out of control?"
"Yes."
"I got 20 of my boys out there steering it."
A fleeting thought told him he shouldn't have called his black help boys, since, as Serena kept drumming into him, the Richmans were Jewish and liberal. But it was only that, a fleeting thought.
"And that's why we do it at night, too, when the dew falls and it's damp and there's no wind."
He sighed.
"You know, Herb, I love that smell. I really do. Far as I'm concerned, nobody ever made a perfume that can touch it."
Still gazing into the distance, Herb Richman said, "It's amazing." But in the irritatingly indifferent way he had of making such observations. Then he said, "What happens to the wildlife in a big fire like that?" Charlie gave an amused snort.
"Happens to 'em. They run, or else they fly. That's what happens. You can see 'em. I've been out there in the field for a lot of burnovers, and you can see animals you didn't even know was there running ahead of the flames. I'll tell you what's really something. That's the snakes, especially the rattlers. People will tell you how fast a snake can move, but they really can't, not in miles per hour or anything like that. They can't outrun the flames, so what they do is they burrow down into the ground. They get under the earth, and as soon as the fire's passed over 'em, they come out of their holes and they get the hell out of there. You can see 'em. Of course, you gotta watch yourself, 'cause they're not in a good mood at that point. The ground is still hot, and here are all these snakes slithering along like there's no tomorrow. It's just one hell of a sight. No, the wildlife know what to do about fire, 'cause it'll occur spontaneously out in the woods. The only ones that don't make out so well are the turtles. Next day you'll find all these burnt-out turtle shells in the woods."
Herb Richman turned his head to look at Charlie. In the darkness, Charlie couldn't tell exactly what the man's expression was, but he said to himself, "Oh, shit. Why did I have to mention the dead turtles? Anybody who uses the expression wildlife is going to be sensitive about the dead turtles." Aloud, he said,
"But you don't have to worry about the turtles. They survive. They survive. There's no older animal in the woods than the turtle."
"You actually burn over the whole plantation?" asked Herb Richman.
"Yep."
"Well, then, where do the animals go? Where do the quail go?"
Before you start the burnover, you go out there and you create feeding patches everywhere. You take your bulldozers and you dig fire breaks in a big circle. Inside the circles, they're like islands, the feeding patches are. You got trees, grass, beggar weed, corn, all the things the quail like. The other animals, too, for that matter. By fall, the burned-over field, they got a nice stand of sedge again, but most of the undergrowth is gone, and it's good hunting out there."
"Well, don't the pine trees burn, too?"
"Not if your people know what they're doing. A good healthy stand of pine, the trunks might get scorched, but the whole tree's not going to go up in flames. Oh, the scrubs might burn up, but that's nature's way of culling the stock, too. Fire in the woods is a natural thing."
Now Charlie and his guests grew quiet, transfixed by the flaming tableau before them. If you stared long enough, the flames began to play tricks on your eyes. It was an overcast night, and the sky was black, and the ground between the terrace and the arc of flames was black, and the fire seemed to be floating in space somewhere beyond the perpendicular silhouettes of the pine trees, which in turn seemed to draw closer and then recede. Draw closer, and then recede once more. And now, way out there somewhere, you could hear the boys shouting to one another. Not the words, just the music of their voices. So far as Charlie was concerned,
What he was now treating his guests to was one of the greatest pageants, one of the greatest symphonies in all the world.
He noticed with satisfaction that, here in the darkness, Herb Richmond had slipped his arm around his wife Marcia's waist and drawn her close to him. Perhaps the man was at last responding to the turpentine spell. By and by they all came back inside the gunhouse, and Charlie offered everybody something to drink. But the Richmonds said they were ready to turn in for the evening, and so did the Knoxes, and so did Dr. Ted Nashford and his live-in Lydia. Then Wally left, without saying anything. And then Slim and Veronica Tucker pulled out, and then Serena told him she was heading back to the big house, where the Richmonds were staying, to make sure they had everything they needed. Charlie got the picture. Pretty soon there would be just him and Opie McCorkle and Billy, and maybe Doris. So while there were a few souls still left, Charlie beckoned Billy into a little office he had off the entry gallery in the gunhouse, and closed the door and said,
"Billy, what the hell was that you were getting ready to see about Farik Fannin?"
Billy, who was already working on another bourbon and water, gave Charlie a funny smile and didn't say a thing.
"Hey, Billy, it's me, Charlie."
Billy knocked back a little more of his drink, and then he said,
"I shouldn't have said the first thing about it, Charlie. I told him I wouldn't."
"Told who, Farik Fannin?"
"No, Inman."
"Inman Armholster? What's he got to do with it?"
Billy grew silent again, and once more stared at Charlie, but rather vacantly. Then he said,
"Well, I think Inman's gonna want to talk to you anyway. But in the meantime, this stays in this room. I don't even want you telling Serena. Will you promise me that?"
"Yeah."
"Inman claims Fannin raped his daughter."
"What?"
"That's what he says."
"Elizabeth, you're kidding."
"No, I'm not kidding."
"Jesus H. Christ. How'd he say... They were my guests here just a couple months ago. Elizabeth and Inman and Ellen. Next to last weekend of the quail season. Well, hell, you remember that. You were here, too. How'd this happen?"
"Well, according to Inman, Elizabeth was up in Fannin's room at some kind of party on the first night of Freaknik, on that Friday."
"Fannin's room? The first night of Freaknik? What the hell was she doing up in Fannin's room on the first night of Freaknik?"
"Inman says there were two other white students there, two girls, and one of them saw what happened, but she's scared to death, and now she claims she didn't see anything."
"Christ almighty."
Charlie lowered his eyes and shook his head, and then looked up at Billy again.
"I don't believe this. What's Fannin like? Any idea?"
"Oh, man," said Billy, "don't ask. You missed that meeting of the Stingers where McNutter brought him out and introduced him to everybody. He won't do that again. It was a disaster. You've heard this term, attitude? Well, this guy is 225 pounds of attitude. He comes out wearing a diamond in each earlobe and a gold necklace about yay thick. He don't even smile. No ingratiating himself with a bunch of old broken-down white-has-been athletes from long ago. McNutter gives him the microphone, and all he does is mutter a few words that sound like he's taking the Fifth Amendment. He looks at everybody like we're dirt underneath his feet. The worst picture you ever had in your mind about a pampered athlete, there you got our boy Farik."
"What's Elizabeth Armholster like?" asked Charlie.
"I don't really know," said Billy. "I saw her when she came out at the driving club last year. She probably looked fabulous. Most of them do."
"She's a sexy-looking little lamb chop," said Charlie. "She came along with my party with Inman and Ellen that weekend. She made sure everybody knew she had a body."
"Well, hell, Charlie, rape's rape, no matter what kind of body the girl has." I'm not saying it isn't. I mean, Jesus Christ, I was just making an observation.
What's Inman going to do?
Inman don't know what to do. But you know Inman, he's a hot-headed son of a gun. And you can count on it he's going to do something. What's got him stumped right now is that he don't want Elizabeth's name to get out. And with her being the daughter of someone as prominent as he is, he don't know how he can keep it from getting out. And he says Elizabeth is so traumatized by the whole thing, she don't want to talk to the police about it or the people at Tech or anybody else. So for now, what he's doing is, he's going to the board.
Tech's board?
He's a great buddy of the new chairman, Holland Jasper.
Oh, yeah, I know him.
There's been a lot of changes on the board, Charlie, and guess what they're coming out strong on?
What?
The football program. They think Tech's lost too much ground over the past 10 years. Everything slumps when the football team slumps. The legislature comes through with less money. Alumni contributions fall off. The SAT scores of the applicants drop. Everything comes down.
The SAT scores come down?
That's what Inman told me, said Billy.
What's he care about the SAT scores?
He don't care, but when he talked to Holland Jasper, he got kind of a rude awakening, seems to me. He thought Jasper would drop everything and call out the cavalry when he told him what had happened to his daughter. Instead, Jasper starts double-talking him and telling Inman how we have to take everything into consideration and how the student government has its own mechanism for dealing with sexual harassment, and he's double-talking him some more, and Inman's yelling at him and saying, "I'm not talking about sexual harassment, you imbecile. I'm talking about flat-out rape."
I'd have liked to seen that.
Well, you know what the bottom line is, Charlie. The board's number one priority is to build the football program. They've hired Buck McNutter away from Alabama for $875,000 a year and given him a big house in Buckhead. And they got an All-American running back named Farik Fannin. Every magazine, every Capital Contributors brochure, every admissions office flyer, they got a picture of Farik Fannin shaking off tacklers and heading for open country. Suddenly, Inman finds himself up against some of the harsh realities of modern life.
Is he angry?
Angry? He's hopping, Inman is. He's fit to be tied. He's going to do something. Right now seems like he's trying to line up some Tech people against Holland Jasper. That's why he came to see me and told me all this. And I'll bet you anything he gets in touch with you. Only you got to make out like you ain't heard the first word about the whole thing. He made me swear up and down I wouldn't tell a living soul.
Well, hell, like I said, Billy, it's me, Charlie.
I know, but you got to swear on the Bible.
Okay, said Charlie. I swear.
In the morning, after breakfast, Charlie led them all the guests, plus Serena and Wally, out to a small but smart-looking barn, made of old brick, with a slate roof, not far from the stables. It was a fine spring day. Inside the barn, it took a moment to adjust your eyes to the contrasts of light and dark. Since there were no windows in the walls, only a row of clerestory windows under the eaves. All at once, as if on cue, a great shaft of sunlight, vibrating with dust particles, streamed down from one of the little windows and lit up the dirt floor like a stage. There, spotlit by the sunbeam, was a narrow wooden enclosure with low walls, a type of stall known as a stock, and in the stock stood a large pale bay mare. The warm, heavy gumbo smell of horse flesh filled the place, suffused every rhinal cavity, permeated your very gizzard. Two stable hands, both of them black, were busy buckling straps that ran from the mare's neck to her hind legs. A short but chesty little white man stood by, giving instructions. He was barely 5 feet tall and had a close-cropped ginger-red beard that took on a curious sheen in the sunlight. He was Charlie's stud manager, the Australian Johnny Groiner. Charlie's guests stood off to the side in the shadows. Billy Bass and Opie McCorkle were rocked back on their heels, chatting with Slim Tucker and Howell Hendricks. Letty Withers had Francine Hendricks, Ted Nashford, Veronica Tucker, and Lenore Knox for an audience. Herb and Marcia Richmond were huddled together over near Serena, Wally, Live-In Lydia, and Beecham Knox. From time to time, everyone glanced at the mayor. Herb and Marcia Richmond glanced at each other, too. They looked tired and apprehensive. Or was he, Charlie, just imagining it? Herb Richmond turned toward him and said, "What do you call this, Charlie?"
"The breedin' barn," said Charlie.
"And you use it for..."
"Breedin'."
"You mean..."
"Well, this is where they mate," said Charlie. "This is where it takes place."
"You need a special building for it?"
"Yep," said Charlie. "You'll see why."
The next thing he knew, Serena had come over and was taking him aside, deeper into the shadows.
"You sure you want to do this?" she said. "The Richmonds don't look very happy."
"Well, don't tell me they're Jewish and liberal," said Charlie. "This has got nothing to do with Jewish or not Jewish or liberal or not liberal. This has got to do with the way life is."
They're not country people, Charlie. They're sensitive."
"Oh, hell, they'll be fascinated. Weren't you? You know you were, and you're not a country person either."
"Well..."
She shook her head and grimaced slightly.
"What do you want me to do, take 'em all out of here and say, 'Well, that's it, folks'?"
The truth was, since the quail season was over and they couldn't go hunting, Charlie had planned this as one of the weekend's big events. The thought that Herb Richmond might not be impressed by what he was about to see had never even crossed Charlie's mind. Richmond was about to see one of the greatest horses in the country in a role people always read about, but the true nature of which they couldn't begin to guess. Besides, this was the only big event on the schedule today. So, without another word to Serena, he returned to the guests. By now, the other little Australian, Melvin Bonnetbox, or Bonnie, as everyone called him, had joined Johnny Groiner over near the mare. Bonnie was Johnny's steerer, as this peculiar breed of specialist was known. The two of them, Johnny and Bonnie, looked like a pair of middle-aged elves standing next to the stable hands, all of them black, who conferred with them. And now the mare's attendants, having finished putting the straps on her hind legs, were buckling a leather mantle over her lower neck and her withers, and furling her tail up until it looked bobbed.
"What are those straps for?" asked Herb Richmond.
"Keep her from kicking," said Charlie. "One kick in the testicles and you've lost a $3 million stud."
He noticed with satisfaction that the entire entourage was listening. He sucked in his breath and put his shoulders back. The drag of insomnia was finally fading away. He had been having trouble sleeping ever since the workout session at Planner's Bank, and last night had only made it worse. Before they went to bed, Serena had continued her lecture about the Richmonds and told him what a disaster the dinner had been. Billy Bass and Judge McCorkle and all their broad humor about AIDS. Herb and Marcia Richmond were Jewish and liberal, and you could read the distress in their faces, and so forth and so on. Only Wally had come close to saying what was probably on their minds. Charlie had on his khakis and a pair of low Wellington boots. He was wearing a .45-caliber revolver, a huge thing, on his right hip. Herb and Marcia Richmond kept checking it out, and so did Wally, even though he had seen it many times before.
Good. Let them check it out.
For the first time all day he felt like himself, like Cap'n Charlie, the boss, the master of Turpentine. He called out,
"When you all gonna be ready, Johnny?"
"Ready now, Cap'n,"
said the little man with the bright red beard.
"Then let's bring him on in."
Johnny Groiner motioned toward one of the black workmen who left the barn. Presently he returned, leading a light chestnut horse in through the doorway. A stallion, as was obvious from the fact that the animal's penis was already half-distended beneath his belly. The stallion was snorting and pawing the ground, and throwing his head and neck this way and that, and lurching into a nervous sidewise gait as the handler struggled to pull his head down and keep him under control. The beast forced his head up and cut loose with a tremendous whinny before the handler jerked it back down again. Charlie's guests were silent, all eyes. By the time the stallion moved out into the shaft of sunlight, it was obvious that he was neither very big nor very young. In fact, he was slightly smaller than the mare. The handler led him to the rear of the stock, where another black workman lifted the wooden bar over the entryway, and two more held the mare by her halter. Snorting, highly agitated, the stallion walked into the stock and right up to the rear end of the mare. The mare began twitching and rolling her head and switching her furled-up tail. The stallion's penis was now a tremendous black shaft. Suddenly, he extended his head and his long neck and pushed his nose into the mare's rear end, into her vulva. She tried to kick with her rear legs, but the hobble straps prevented it. She tried to bolt forward, but the walls of the stock hemmed her in, and the stable hands held her halter. The stallion kept twisting his head, rooting around in her vulva. Charlie noticed that most of his guests lowered their chins and pulled them inward, as if shrinking, all the while staring, transfixed. The deep voice of Letty Withers,
"Good Lord, Charlie, I thought this was the Bible Belt. That looks suspiciously like oral sex."
But no one laughed, and no one else said anything. The truth was, they were shocked. All at once a gusher of yellowish liquid shot out the rear of the mare. The stallion pulled back. His lower jaw, throat latch, and breast were dripping with it. It was urine, which continued to spew out. The stallion shook his head and whinnied and started back toward the mare, his penis fully erect. But two black handlers had him by the halter and were forcing him back away from the stock. He snorted, whinnied, pawed the ground, and started slapping his penis against his underbelly. The handlers kept forcing him to back up. Once he was clear of the wall of the stock, they yanked him away from it altogether and began leading him toward the doorway, while he tried to jerk free of the halter and slapped his penis against his belly some more.
"What's going on?" asked Howell Hendricks. "Why are they taking him away?"
The other guests closed ranks in order to hear the answer.
"He's not the stud," said Charlie. "He's the teaser."
"The teaser?"
"Yep. You just used the teaser to get her aroused."
"And she urinates in his face?" said Howell.
"Yep, always happens."
"And that's all he gets out of it?"
"That's about the size of it."
"Terrific," said Howell. "Reminds me of when I was in high school."
Ted Nashford and his little Lydia, Slim and Veronica Tucker, Francine Hendricks, Letty, and Lenore Knox laughed. Even Herb and Marcia Richmond smiled. Charlie felt superior to the whole bunch of them. City people always felt compelled to make jokes about what went on in the breeding barn, which was, in fact, the most serious thing in the world. The mare stood there in the stock with her shanks spread slightly apart. Beneath her bound tail was an astonishingly large, soft, moist, dark, liverish crevice of flesh, and the flesh was writhing. It opened up and then contracted, opened up and contracted, opened up and contracted. It was the beast's vulva. She was now fully aroused, writhing uncontrollably.
"My God," said Letty, "what's that?"
"It's called winking," said Charlie.
"Really?" said Letty, with one of her contralto chuckles.
"Winking?"
"That's what it's called," said Charlie matter-of-factly, to show he was not making a joke. By now one of the black handlers was busy swabbing the convulsing crevice with a sponge, which he kept dipping into the bucket at his feet. In the bucket was a physohex solution. To ensure a successful conception, Charlie explained, the mare's genitals had to be kept antiseptic, and there was no telling what kind of dirt was on the teaser's nose. Letty and the others watched with undisguised fascination. The stud manager, Johnny Groiner, walked over to Charlie.
"I'd say it's about that time, Cap'n. Time for Si to have his go."
Herb Richman looked from Johnny to Charlie.
"Si's the stud," said Charlie. "First Draw's his real name. Si's his barn name."
"First Draw," said Herb Richman. "Why does that ring a bell?"
"Used to race him," said Charlie. 6 years ago he won the Breeders' Cup."
Then to the stud manager,
"Okay, Johnny, I'm going to go get him."
With that, Charlie walked out of the barn, leaving Herb Richman and one and all, he assumed, impressed. As soon as he got outside, he could feel the heat of the sun. It was so bright it took a moment for his eyes to adjust. His knee began to ache terribly, and he wondered if it was because of anxiety over what he now had to do. Just to the rear of the barn, there he was, the black stallion. He was huge, a behemoth. A stable hand, named Clint, held him close to the halter by a lead line. The stallion shifted his weight and tried to crane his neck, and his hide rippled in the sunlight. Clint's dark face was already glistening with sweat from the exertion of leading him from the stable to this point. Now the stallion began to snort and jerk his head about. Clint, who was a big man and at least 25 years younger than Charlie, had his hands full. The mighty First Draw had made this trip to the breeding barn many times and knew exactly what was coming.
"Oh, he's randy, Cap'n Charlie. He's always randy, Clint. Many times he's done this, think he'd calm down after a while. I know, Cap'n, but this time he is some kind of randy. You best be watching out for him when he sets foot in that barn in there."
Charlie surveyed the horse from front to back.
"Well, Clint, here goes."
As soon as he took the lead line, he knew he was in for a battle. The stallion began lifting his head and straightening his neck. It was all Charlie could do to yank his head down.
"Ha! Ho! Si! Ho! Ho! Cut it out!"
This last in as deep and rough a voice as possible, as much to impress Clint as the animal. He slid his hand up the lead line, closer to the beast's mouth. Racing thoroughbreds were so high-strung, they were fully capable of biting if there was enough slack in the line. Jesus Christ, why hadn't he told them to put a breeding bridle on him, which would have meant there was a bit in his mouth to keep him in check? Well, couldn't ask for one now. Cap'n Charlie would lose too much face. Even before he had led him as far as the doorway, the stallion began breathing heavily through the nostrils in what seemed almost a groan, and prancing in an eccentric sidewise gait. Charlie could feel the muscles in his forearm tighten as he fought to maintain control. A terrible realization bubbled up into his brain. If this beast knew his own strength and had the willpower, no man on earth could have kept him from doing whatever he wanted. Suppose he, Cap'n Charlie, lost control of him in there, in front of that audience. But what was this? He had never before even allowed such doubts to enter his skull.
"Si! Ho! Ho! Ha! Ho!"
As they entered the doorway, the stallion breathed in the full, overpowering smell of the mare in heat and launched into a ferocious show of machismo. He snorted. He rolled his massive shoulders. He flexed his neck up and down and yawed it back and forth. He did a little dance with his hindquarters, and he whinnied. He whinnied in anger, in agony, in desperation and anticipation. Had he possessed bigger vocal cords, he would have sounded like 10 trumpets. He bared his teeth, rolled his eyes, whinnied some more. He looked like an immense equine lunatic. Charlie set his jaws and tried to look totally in command and held on for dear life. His eyes were slow in readjusting to the gloom. Over here, a dazzling cone of light, the mare in the stock, the stable hands. Over there, slowly taking shape in the shadows. Letty, Wally, Serena, Herb and Marcia Richman, and the rest of them. They were huddled together. Their eyes were like saucers. As he fought to keep the beast's head down, Charlie could feel its huge body shuddering with lust, the rawest, purest lust imaginable. He could feel his own arm shaking, trying so desperately to keep the stud's head down. Could they tell? The final 20 feet, out into the shaft of light, where the mare waited. The mare and, thank God, Johnny Groiner and his helpers. Charlie had to fight every inch of the way. The brilliance of the sunlight and the heavy, humid smell of flesh made him feel dizzy.
"Johnny," he said, he's a Randy," he fought to get his breath. "He's a Randy, son of a bitch."
"Ain't he always, Cap'n," said the little stud manager. Then he turned toward two of the black stable hands. "Okay, boys." One of them took the lead line, and the other held on to a halter strap. Charlie hoped that Herb Richman and Wally and the rest of them took note of the fact that it required two men to hold the snorting beast he had just brought in by himself. He walked toward his guests. He was suddenly aware of how hard he was breathing, and he had led the big animal no more than 40 or 50 yards. He took a deep breath and displayed the fullness of his chest. He had made it. He had brought the beast in without looking like an old fool. He felt as if somehow he shared in the stud's power. Both the stud and the mare were now out in the cone of light, along with Johnny and his little Australian sidekick Bonnie, and 6 stable hands. All of them, not just the 2 Australians, looked tiny next to the 2 great beasts. The stud, snorting, rolling his huge muscles, was fast building up to a full erection. Inside its sheath, his penis looked like a huge, long, dark, evil leather knout hanging down from beneath his legs. All the while the beast trumpeted, whinnied, snorted, proclaimed his power. Now Johnny was out in the middle of the floor, gesturing like a symphony conductor toward the stud, and then toward the mare, and barking out instructions to his men.
"Okay, Alonzo, bring her on out."
The 3 handlers at the breeding stock began backing the mare out of the little enclosure. The beast's vulva continued to writhe. The hobbles on her rear legs made the going slow. Now she was out of the stock, and the stable hands turned her away from the stallion, so that her rear end faced him, while she twitched, lashed her bobbed tail, and shook her neck. The stud was beside himself. His nostrils flared, his eyes looked maniacal, his huge black body shook with waves of lust. The stable hands could barely hold him back. Charlie's guests had dropped all pretense of aloofness or detachment.
Even such unlikely mates as Beecham Knox and Veronica Tucker were huddled together, wayfarers suddenly marooned in a fast-rising storm. Sex. Lust. Each of the great beasts weighed close to a ton, almost 10 times the size of a big man like Billy Bass, and 15 or 16 times the size of any woman in the little group of well-heeled human beings who now stood bunched together on the dirt floor of the breeding barn. The mare was beginning to act up. She knew what was coming, too. By now her handlers, holding on to her halter, were having to dance in the dirt just to keep their balance. Johnny Groiner, his beard flaming in the sunlight, stood between the 2 animals, both hands up in the air. He pointed toward the mare.
"Alonzo, put the twitch on her!"
The tallest of the mare's handlers, Alonzo, wrapped a length of leather around the flesh above her upper teeth and twisted it tight. The pain would distract her from her concern over what was about to happen to her backside.
"Wilson! Lift a foot! Lift a bloody foot!"
Another handler reached down and grasped the pastern of the mare's right foreleg and lifted the hoof off the ground so that she couldn't bolt forward. Now Johnny Groiner pointed toward the stud.
"All right, boys. Bring him up, bring him up!"
A regular platoon was gathered around the big black stallion. Two stable hands held the animal's head by the lead line and the halter. Two more were posted back by his haunches, one on each side. Bonnie stood beside one flank in a slight crouch, his hands up in front of him, as if ready to spring into action. As they led him forward, the stud began snorting and whinnying and prancing more wildly than ever. He was within 10 feet of the mare when Johnny Groiner held up his right palm and yelled,
"Whoa! Whoa! Montrose! Lewis! Get us some hay!"
The two men hustled off to a bin along the wall and returned with bales of hay, which they proceeded to stack under the mare's belly. Herb Richmond turned toward Charlie and said in a low voice, "What are they doing?"
"He's so wound up, they're afraid she's going to collapse when he mounts her."
Now the hay was in place, and all the handlers were back in position. Johnny Groiner looked toward the mare's crew and extended one arm, palm up, and said,
"She ready?"
Alonzo nodded yes. Then he looked toward the stallion and extended his other arm, palm upward, and said,
"He ready?"
Bonnie nodded yes. The little stud manager had both arms lifted upward and outward, as if he were spreading his wings. To Bonnie,
"Okay! Bring him up! Bring him up! Bring him up!"
The stallion's handlers were now struggling for all they were worth, as they let the animal move closer to the mare's cavernous vulva, which was now winking madly. To Alonzo,
"Be alive! Be alive! Don't let her stagger when she breaks down!"
To Bonnie and the stallion's crew,
"All right, boys! All right, boys! All right, boys!"
All at once the mare spread her haunches, opened her vulva wide, and seemed almost to squat. She was breaking down, abandoning her struggle, opening up unconditionally, surrendering utterly. At that moment the stud manager, his beard a brilliant red in the sunlight, his arms stretched out like wings, brought his hands together, slamming the heel of his right hand into the palm of his left with a tremendous smack. The stallion's handlers released their hold. The mare's handlers gave her back her foreleg. The stallion reared. His head, his wild eyes, his flared nostrils, his bared teeth, his huge neck, his forelegs, his massive chest rose up until the great beast appeared to be towering on tiptoe above the world. The little Australian, Bonnie, jumped forward, almost beneath the animal's belly. Smash! The stallion came crashing down on the mare's back and drove his enormous penis toward her yawning vulva. The very ground shook beneath Charlie and his band of guests. The quake rattled their innards. The planets collided. The earth wobbled. Sex. Lust. Desperate. Irresistible. The force was so great it drove the mare forward. She struggled to keep her feet. Her belly was pressed down on the bales of hay, which slid forward with her. For an instant it appeared that Bonnie must have been crushed between the two of them, or else spavined, when the stallion's hooves came crashing down. Johnny Groiner was skittering along beside the mare's hindquarters, shouting,
"Bonnie! Bonnie!"
Now you could see Bonnie again. He had both hands wrapped around the stallion's huge penis, which furiously sought the mare's vagina. This was Bonnie's moment. He was the steerer. He whose task it was to steer the stallion's erect penis squarely into the proper channel of the mare's vagina. His feet danced along crazily, and his head seemed to have disappeared between the groins of the two beasts as the stallion's mighty haunches and 2,000 pounds of thrust drove them all, man and beast, across the floor of the barn. Johnny Groiner kept shouting,
"Lower, Bonnie! Lower, Bonnie! Lower and up! Lower and up!"
Bonnie struggled to make sure the penis entered the vulva at the proper downward angle, then thrust up into the vagina.
"Push!" screamed Johnny Groiner. "Push, goddammit! This way! This way! This way! Steady! This way!"
The three stable hands leaned in at a fierce angle, shoving the mare's flank and skittering across the dirt. Three frantic little tugboats attending a stupendous thundering act of coitus beneath the very belly, beside the very rutting rod of the stallion. The stallion was no longer the magnificent thoroughbred who just moments before had reared up on his hind legs, trumpeting as if he were the reigning king of all the animal kingdom. his forelegs, those visions of the graceful racing stride when he had won the Breeders' Cup just a few years before, now hung awkwardly, ridiculously, uselessly, like a pair of vestigial appendages, down either side of the mare's back. His great neck and head, and above all his eyes, now looked like those of a demented creature, as he tried over and over to bite the mare's neck. His teeth sunk instead into the leather mantle that had been placed over her neck and withers for that very reason. Otherwise, in his uncontrollable sexual fury, he would have chewed her raw. All the while, his haunches, his thighs, his buttocks, the seat of the stupendous power that had propelled him, the great first draw, this great poem in motion, this embodiment of power and coordination to glorious victories on the track, this magnificent engine was reduced to a single jerky, spastic, convulsive, compulsive motion. Rut, 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 rut. His entire musculature, rippling beneath his hot black hide in the shaft of sunlight, indeed his very hide itself, every ounce of his 1 ton, his $3 million worth of horseflesh, was now a hopeless, helpless slave to that single synaptic impulse. Rut, 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 while a sexual valet, an Australian elf, with his bare hands, steered the rut-mad penis into a yawning vaginal canal, and an army of human beings, mere Lilliputians, pushed and shoved, and a little red-bearded conductor waved his arms about, and the lot of them, man and beast, careened 20, 30, 40 feet across the barn's dirt floor with thousands of pounds of rut-lust momentum. Suddenly the slide ended. The paroxysmal jerks ceased, and the stallion gave a sigh and a noisy groan, a cross between a snort and a whinny. A pathetic whine was what it was, compared to the mighty overture he had sung just seconds before. Then he slid back off the mare. His forelegs looked more ridiculous than ever, as they slithered back over her hide. He was finished, utterly spent. Despite his enormous size, he suddenly looked powerless. One of the handlers took him by the halter. But was it even necessary? He wasn't going anywhere. He certainly wasn't running. His penis, that once almighty rod, was still distended, but it was now an ugly, distorted black mess, slimy, oozing semen and dripping with the mare's lubricant. It looked more like a wet shillelagh than a penis, a lumpy, knotty, misshapen length of stick. Then, before the astonished eyes of Charlie's guests, the tip of it began to swell up. It swelled, 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 until it looked like a mushroom, an enormous and exceptionally noxious black mushroom with a long, black, gristly stem. The mushroom and its shillelagh shaft hung down in a weary fashion. The great beast looked dead, out on his feet. His head drooped. His gait was that of an old mule. As the stable hand led him away, he didn't so much as glance back at the mare. Not once. Not a nod, not a twitch, not so much as a sigh or a sentimental snort for the creature who just moments before had obsessed every neuron of his central nervous system.
Yes, but will he call her in the morning?
It was the throaty baritone of Letty Withers. They all looked at Letty and at one another. Herb Richman, Marcia Richman, Ted Nashford, Lenore Knox, the whole lot of them. They were stunned by what they had just witnessed, and Letty's joke wasn't enough to snap them out of it. So Doris Bass tried.
Now watch him light up a cigarette.
Slim Tucker said,
"Is this what they mean by date rape?"
Howell Hendricks said,
"Don't knock it if you haven't tried it."
Veronica Tucker said,
"That was a real meat and potatoes kind of guy."
Francine Hendricks said,
"Oh, you guys are all the same."
Billy Bass said,
"Charlie, maybe. Not me."
They all tried, and nobody could manage to laugh. They had been jolted. They had just witnessed something so unexpected, so powerful, so elemental. They were all overwhelmed, however inchoately, by the same question. What does it mean? Charlie knew that much because he felt it himself. He felt it all over again every time he watched one of these sessions in the breeding barn. And this time, as he had led the stallion into the barn, he had felt the great beast's urge to procreate in his very bones. It had traveled down his arms, the beast's uncontrollable desire had, and into his shoulders, down into his solar plexus. Oh, he knew what it meant, but where could he find the words? He stepped in front of the group, in front of Serena and Wally and his guests, and as he spoke, his eyes locked onto Herb Richmond's. Herb and his wife, Marcia, had numb expressions, and their shoulders were up and their heads were lowered, as if they were retreating into shells.
"Well, that's it," said Charlie.
He found, to his surprise, that he was breathing heavily and his shirt was wet beneath his armpits.
"There you have it. People can say whatever they want. They can talk about gay rats or anything else they want."
He stopped to take a couple of deep breaths.
"They can talk about gay rats until they're blue in the face."
He was so out of breath.
"They can worship gay rats as if Moses brought 'em down from the mountaintop. They can close their eyes and dream of whatever'll make 'em feel better. But there," he gestured toward the stallion and the mare, "there's the heart of it."
He took another deep breath.
"That's what it all boils down to at the end, the male and the female, and that's it."
He studied Herb Richmond's face for a reaction. All he could make out was pain and paralysis. Why? Why? What did that strange look mean? Could Serena possibly be right? Had he been shocked and affronted by what he had just seen? Was he that sensitive? That liberal? That Jewish? Just then Johnny Groiner came bouncing over. He was obviously elated. He was grinning. His ginger-red beard fairly blazed with high spirits.
"Well, Cap'n," he said, "went perfect."
He was breathing hard and sweating, too.
"Couldn't have been better."
"Looked great, Johnny," said Charlie. "You guys did a great job."
But his mind was still spinning with Herb Richmond, Herb Richmond, Herb Richmond. Then he got an idea. Liberal. Liberal. He wouldn't treat Johnny, the conductor of the show, like a hired hand. He'd introduce him. Equality. Equality. Liberal. Jewish. "Johnny," he said, "I want you to meet one of our guests. Hebe Richmond." What had he just said? A scalding feeling swept over his brain.
"I mean, Herb Richmond. God almighty, Herb, I must be losing my grip, I guess."
He lifted his hands helplessly.
"Herb Richmond, Johnny."
He looked about. Everyone had heard him.
"Jesus, Herb, that must be my Alzheimer's flaring up."
And why had he said Jesus? Herb Richmond's pale face turned scarlet, and then a soft, embarrassed smile spread over his features, and he turned toward Johnny Groiner and put out his hand and said, "It's nice to meet you, Johnny. That was quite something." What have I just said? Then Herb Richmond turned back toward Charlie, and with the same soft smile on his face, patted him twice on the arm, as if to say, "There, there." Charlie opened his mouth, but at first no words came out. Then he said hoarsely,
"Herb, I think I'm losing my marbles."
Herb Richmond continued to smile, but his eyes were about 33 degrees Fahrenheit. Then he made a grunting noise deep in his chest, approximating a chuckle, or a punch in the solar plexus. Charlie didn't dare look at Marcia Richmond, or Serena, or Wally, or anyone else who might have heard. A wave swept through his central nervous system, and told him he had just blown 7 floors of the Croker Concourse Tower, and $10 million a year in income. Chapter 13 the arrest. All the way back to Atlanta, on this sunny Sunday afternoon, the gaff wafted in the G5's recirculating air like a smell. Charlie sat in the forward cabin upon his leather throne, at his Tupelo maple desk, with Lenore Knox opposite him, and old Governor Knox and Letty Withers sitting just across the aisle. Herb, not Hebe, Richman, and his wife Marcia, and Howell and Francine Hendricks, and Ted Nashford and his live-in Lydia, and Serena and Wally, sat in the rear cabin. Billy and Doris Bass, who had flown back on Billy's own Learjet, and Slim and Veronica Tucker, and Judge Opie McCorkle, who stayed on in Baker County, were not on the flight. But the gaff was, and it would remain on board as long as Charlie and Herb, not Hebe, Richmond, did. Charlie still couldn't believe he had said what he had said. Couldn't believe it. Maybe upon reflection everybody would take it as a simple slip of the lip and not as anything racial in origin. Oh, sure, Charlie. "What's Beecham Jr. got to say about Chicago these days?" Charlie asked Lenore Knox. That and other questions of comparable gravity. But nothing could dispel the smell of the gaff. Charlie wondered if everybody on board was thinking about the gaff. The gaff, and nothing but the gaff, the way he was. He had Gwinnett ask everybody every 3 seconds if he or she would like something to drink, or some ham biscuits, or Sally Lunn with damson preserves. And he had Lud Harnsberger come out of the cockpit and pay attention to the guests, and let them have an eyeful of the spun-gold furs on his big forearms. But nothing was antiseptic enough to remove the stench of, "Johnny, I want you to meet one of our guests, Hebe Richman." As the great G5 touched down at PDK, Charlie was so caught up in the subject of how best to say farewell to Herb Richman, he didn't even look out the window to see what might be awaiting him on that hot, sunny tarmac. Let's see. He'd make a point of being the first off the plane, and he'd stand at the foot of the stairs and press one last effusion of hospitality upon his guests, and especially Herb and Marcia, as if nothing embarrassing had ever occurred. The ship came to a halt, and Charlie's right knee began throbbing as soon as he stood up. In due course the G5's stairs were lowered, and he looked down diligently before putting weight on his aching knee. And so he failed to notice the 10 men who were emerging from the arrivals building and hustling across the asphalt apron. Charlie had already assumed his stance of maximum bonhomie at the foot of the stairs, squinting in the bright sunlight. And Lenore Knox, Letty Withers, Ted Nashford, and Live-In Lydia were heading down the stairs when a sharp voice said, "Mr. Charles E. Croker?" Charlie looked about. There, behind him, was a short, balding, squarely built little bulldog of a man, about 40 probably, with a prognathous jaw. He wore a gray suit and some sort of go-to-hell necktie, and held a sheaf of papers in his hairy paws. At first, Charlie didn't make out the composition of the crew of 9 he had brought with him. "Mr. Croker," the little bulldog continued, "my name is Martin Thorgan, counsel representing Planners Bank, and I have here an order," he thrust some papers at Charlie, "executed by the Superior Court, DeKalb County, Judge Omer Lee Listless presiding, calling for the arrest and removal of this aircraft, N number 741FS, model Gulfstream 5, a chattel against which a lien exists, as partial satisfaction of defalcatory loans owed said bank by the Croker Global Corporation." Charlie stared at this jut-jawed little man, from whom such a stream of legalistic block phrases poured, and then he began to take in the men who accompanied him. Near him, a step behind, was a tall, rangy, athletic-looking young man with a long neck, a head of thick black hair, and a wild stare, who looked as if he had been wrestled into the lawyer-like gray suit he wore. Behind the two lawyers were 3 policemen wearing smoky bear hats and the navy shirts and gray trousers, with black stripes down the legs, of the DeKalb County Sheriff's Office. All three were tall, and two of them were real country boys, the raw-boned kind, who liked to get drunk on Saturday night and go down to the railroad grade crossing and have a rock fight. Behind the cops were three young men wearing navy blue windbreakers. Charlie couldn't read the lettering on them at first. And two men in suits Charlie realized he knew all too well. Ray Peepgas, and that guy Zell, or Zale, the one with the rasping voice and the big chin. The bastards! They wait until the G5 is full of guests so they can pull this. Letty, Lenore, and Ted Nashford and Livin Lydia had already heard the whole thing and were bound to realize what was in progress. Charlie looked lawyer Martin Thorgan up and down and said, "Let me see that order." Lawyer Martin Thorgan handed a sheet of paper to Charlie, and without giving it so much as a glance, Charlie took it and tore it in two, and then in four, and then in eight, and then he threw the pieces at the feet of the lawyer. Several pieces stuck to his pants legs electrostatically. "That's what said order amounts to," said Charlie. He looked past Lawyer Thorgan, searching out Peepgas's face. "You dream this stunt up, Ray? Or did your sidekick?"
"Didn't take much dreaming up," said Peepgas. "We talked to you weeks ago about the need to sell this airplane. You never seriously put it on the market. We found you a broker, and you just gave him the runaround."
Charlie was amazed that Peepgas could respond so firmly and with such conviction. What had gotten into old Ray? Meantime, Lawyer Thorgan was saying,
"Whatever you choose to do with the order in its printed form doesn't alter a thing, Mr. Croker. The order has been executed, and the Croker Global Corporation is no longer the owner of this aircraft. It is now the property of Planners Bank. These gentlemen here"—he gestured toward the three policemen—"and myself are here solely to carry out the dictates of the court."
Charlie stepped closer to the little canine lawyer until he towered over him, and said in a low and, he hoped, menacing voice,
"You're going to carry out, Dick. That's what you're going to carry out. Now kindly get all your stooges out of the way, so I can tend to my guests."
Then he looked at Peepgas. "Kindly round up all your clowns and goons and get out of my way. I got guests on this airplane, Ray. Either you do the right thing, or what happens next isn't Planners Bank versus the Croker Global Corporation. It's me versus you. You understand what I'm saying?"
"You can say whatever you want, Charlie," said Peepgas, "but nothing can change the fact that the G5 is now ours."
Charlie couldn't believe this. Somewhere Peepgas had found the strength to talk back to him. He stepped toward his guests, his knee buckling as he did. Letty and Lenore were already on the tarmac, and Ted Nashford and Livin Lydia were almost there, and Howell Hendricks and his wife were on the stairway between them. It was obvious from the wary looks on their faces that one and all had had an earful of what was going on. Charlie tried to beam confidently at all six of them. With as cheery a voice as possible, he said,
"Y'all go ahead. Go on into the waiting room. I'll be right there."
He could not believe what was happening. His mind spun, frantically seeking some workable strategy. He'd ignore the bastards. That's what he'd do. He'd get his guests off the ship, and then he'd deal with the situation. He beamed broadly at Beecham Knox and Marcia Richman, who were now heading down the stairs, and at Howell and Francine Hendricks, Ted Nashford, Letty Withers, and Lenore Knox, all of whom had held back, probably in the interest of gossip. It was pretty hard to stand there, as Charlie now was, beaming at everyone and trying to act oblivious of an enemy platoon of 10 men, especially when three of them were policemen. Lawyer Thorgan made it worse by announcing in a loud voice,
"As soon as your guests and crew have disembarked, Mr. Croker, the aircraft will be arrested and removed."
Now Wally was on the G5 stairs, followed by Herb Richman and Serena.
"Dad," said Wally, "what's going on?"
"Nothing," said Charlie. "A whole lot of nothing."
but he could tell from Wally's expression that that wasn't what it looked like. Lawyer Thorgan's voice. "How many people remain on board?" "That's not your concern," said Charlie. "I'm afraid it is. That's Planners Bank's aircraft." "Damn," thought Charlie, "I need a lawyer. And my lawyer's giving me nothing but grief because he wants his $354,000. I'll contest jurisdiction." "The county court has no jurisdiction," he said. "This aircraft is engaged in interstate commerce." "This aircraft," said Martin Thorgan in a tone of exaggerated boredom, "is a chattel encumbered by a chattel mortgage and subject to foreclosure in situ in DeKalb County." "What the hell's a chattel?" "A chattel's a movable possession, and a Gulfstream V aircraft is eminently movable." "Oh, yeah?" said Charlie. "And just how do you think you're going to move it?" "The usual way. Fly it." He gestured toward the three men in the warm-up jackets. "We have a mechanic and two licensed pilots checked out on every model of Gulfstream, and for that matter, most jet airliners." The three men stared blankly at Charlie. He engaged each one of them eye to eye, then said, "You enjoy slimy assignments like this one?" The youngest of the three, a tall, lanky fellow with a mouth much too small for his big head, responded insouciantly, "I'd rather be flying the Concorde, if you want to know the truth, or an F-16, but this is the job that's open." The young man's impudent nonchalance threw Charlie off. Finally he said, "Anything, as long as it pays money, right? You must feel great about yourself." The young man shrugged. "Like to fly. This isn't the first time I've worked on one of these chattel mortgage foreclosures here at PDK either. G5's a nice ship." Now Charlie was aware that Serena and Herb Richman had descended the stairs and were standing near him. Charlie wasn't worrying any more about how to bid goodbye to Herb Richman. Now he had to figure out how to keep from looking like a hapless, bankrupt fool. Serena said, "What's going on, Charlie?" "Nothing," growled Charlie, "just a little misunderstanding." Herb Richman stood just slightly behind Serena. A soft smile played upon his lips, and he looked sleepier than ever. At the top of the stairs, Lud Harnsberger had just emerged from the G5 with the Navy overnight bag he carried, and behind him Charlie could just make out Jimmy Kite and Gwinnett. Charlie held up his hand and motioned for them all to stop. "Hold it, Lud. I'm going to need you and Jimmy and Gwinnett." Then he turned to Serena. "Sweetheart, you take Herb, not Hebe, and everybody into the waiting room. The drivers should be there already. Figure out who goes in which cars, and y'all head on home. I'm going to be tied up here for a spell. Got to take a short trip." He turned to head back to the stairway to the plane, and his knee rocked unsteadily. The pain liked to kill him. Then, faster than he could have imagined such big men could move, the three county cops outflanked him and set up a line at the foot of the stairs. The one in the middle, the one whose belly bulged out over his big leather belt, said, "We can't let you back on the plane, Mr. Croker. We're here to arrest it, pursuant to a court order." "Yeah, and pursuant to what kind of order did you let yourself be talked into picking out a Sunday afternoon when I'm arriving with a dozen guests?" "We're just carrying out instructions, Mr. Croker." "You just work here, right?" said Charlie. All the while, his sense of humiliation was rising alarmingly. This ignominious farce was being played out before his wife, his son, his employees, Lud, Jimmy, and Gwinnett, Herb Richman, and some of the biggest and most widely listened-to mouths in Atlanta, namely garrulous souls like Howell Hendricks and Letty Withers. How could he get around these three monkeys in the sheriff's deputy uniforms, this beef trust, and take command of the G5 and get the hell out of here? If he thought he could have done it, physically, the way he could have done it when he was 30 years old, not 60, he would have muscled the three men aside and stormed up the stairway and into the G5's cabin and ordered Lud and Jimmy to take off. They would have been astonished by how little nevermind he paid their uniforms.
the stupid monkeys. But he wasn't at all sure he could get by them. His right knee was buckling with pain every time he took a step. And these three wouldn't be pushovers. The one with the belly was probably in his mid-30s, and he struck Charlie as a younger version of Durwood. He looked like the kind who'd love to roll in the dirt with you or whack you upside the ear with his nightstick so that you could no longer hear and were in the grip of a mortal pain from your mastoid process to your occipital rim. One of the rules Charlie knew all leaders should follow was, never engage in a fight in the presence of your followers that you can't possibly win. And this was a fight he couldn't possibly win, at least not physically. He sighed and looked about. Over in the doorway of the hangar, all but obscured by the shadows that plunged its immense space into gloom, was a mechanic named Lunny, for Lunsford, an employee of PDK, but one who had been working on Charlie's planes for 6 years at least. Charlie looked at Lunny and got an idea. Just like that, his entire mood changed. He broke into a sage smile and said to the beefy policeman before him, "Well, officer, I can see that. By the way, what's your name?" The policeman hesitated, not sure whether standing here and dutifully revealing his name would compromise him or not. But Charlie's evidently sincere smile loosened him up, and he finally said, "Hunnicutt, Officer Ira Hunnicutt." Or it came out Ira. After a couple of seconds, Charlie realized the man was a Georgia country boy whose name was Ira, which, out in the sticks, including Baker County, would come out Ara, just the way fire came out far. And he got hired by the fire department came out he got hard by the fire department. "Well, Officer Hunnicutt, I can see you're a man who means what he says. But I have to give you fair warning. It's unwise for anyone but me to attempt to move this airplane from where it is right now." "That ain't for me to say," said Officer Hunnicutt. "That's for whoever's acquiring it." "Well," said Charlie, smiling again, "I can only pass along my advice." With that, he turned toward Ludd and Jimmy and beckoned them on down the stairs. "Come on, boys, and you too, Gwinnett. I'll treat you to a beer." He headed toward the waiting room, but suddenly stopped when he came abreast of Peepgas and Zale. Peepgas seemed to shrink, as if trying to pull himself back into a shell. But Zale looked at Charlie down his nose, with his big, melon-shaped chin thrust up. "By the way," said Charlie cheerily, looking at Zale, "you ought to know that a lien on the starboard engine of this airplane is held by MagTrust. We had to go to MagTrust when Planners Bank wouldn't extend us any more credit. Whether you want to be taken off with MagTrust's collateral is something you all ought to be thinking about. I wouldn't if I were you." "We'll bear that in mind," said Zale in his high-grating voice. "We'll keep everybody informed." The young pilot, who had bandied words with Charlie, stepped forward and called out not to Charlie but to Ludd Harnsberger. "Excuse me, I need to ask you something." Now Charlie could see what was on the back of his windbreaker. In fluorescent, day-glow yellow letters, 7 inches high, it said REPO. Above that, in smaller letters about the size of the names printed on the backs of the jerseys of professional football players, it said Planners Bank. That was what all his guests in the waiting room got an eyeful of when they looked out the big plate-glass window. Planners Bank REPO. Ludd looked at Charlie, silently asking if he should talk to the Planners Bank pilot, and Charlie boomed out, "Sure, go ahead." Ludd and Jimmy and Gwinnett were by now down on the tarmac, and Charlie walked, gimping badly, over to the three of them and said in a hushed voice, "Tell him anything he wants to know. You too, Jimmy. Just keep him talking. The longer the better." Whereupon Charlie went gimping on into the waiting room. Serena and Herb Richman were just ahead of him. They had been hanging back, taking it all in. Serena said,
What are you going to do, Charlie?
I'm going to relax. Take it easy, said Charlie.
What are they doing?
A cheery grin. Nothing. They just enjoy spinning their wheels.
The painting.
It came to him. Just like that. One other thing, Charlie said, turning back toward Peep Gas and the big jawed Zale. I got personal effects on that airplane. Zale, in a bored fashion. Don't worry, all personal effects will be returned. One of 'em I want right now, said Charlie. It's a painting by N.C. Wyeth on the bulkhead of the forward cabin. No can do, said Zale. He had his chest and wrestler's gut thrust forward, and his suit jacket wide open, revealing the skulls and crossbones that ran up and down his suspenders. That painting is listed as collateral, $190,000 worth, and title was held by the Croker Global Corporation. Charlie was furious and anguished. More than anything else he possessed, including turpentine itself, the painting symbolized the triumphs of Cap'n Charlie Croker. But he mustn't let them see how he felt. He would just have to get his hands on it tonight or tomorrow, after the surprise this impudent melon-jawed monkey had coming. He forced himself to smile in a knowing way. "Well, I'm putting you on notice. Anything happens to this aircraft,